Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
You know how we get out of this? We find a better narrative. We have to have a better narrative.
Yeah.
Facts and logic aren't going to do it, and narratives rule the day. We have to find a better narrative.
Selling with stories, right?
Yeah.
Selling
sure.
with stories.
I can do it.
And that's tricky for people who spend a lot of time in the world of ideas. And, you know, it's kind of like one of the reasons, like, I don't blame left and right wing people in the traditional political sense of, like, trying to talk to Republicans when Ron Paul was on the scene, or trying to talk to people on the left today. They are just in echo chambers where they feel like they're right. Well, we're outside of that, like trying to get into the conversation and trying to, like, what we're both saying, like, there's no point to doing now, get into, like, having credibility in that scene. So we study both sides. We learn all their arguments. We predict, and, like, we're not the only people who find that useful, how, like, knowing what someone's political affiliation is, you can basically predict what they're going to feel about anything that happens. Like, the scientific managers in society like that, and so do we, because it lets us win arguments. But then those people don't acknowledge that we won arguments, and it's just Groundhog Day the next time we see them, right? We have to live that same day all over again. So we sit outside and we practice and we strategize, and they don't, right? So they don't know what hit them when people who have, you know, traditionally lined up with libertarianism come at them. And, like, the only thing they can do is just edit us out of their reality. You know, I see that happen again and again, and it's gotten, you know, worse in the last 4 or 5 years. So that is a losing battle, right? Outreach is a losing battle. Politics is a losing battle. And if there is going to be, you know, some kind of momentum gained here, I think you're absolutely right. I think Trump came in with a compelling story. It was kind of simple. It was kind of stupid, but it was a story. It was a story about change, and that worked. And, you know, the people who promote freedom and want to see a freer world, you're right, we don't have that.
Hey there, this is Brett. Today is December 31st, 2020. I am sitting in a parked car at an RV park outside Naples, Florida. Now you say an RV park in Florida. That sounds like it could go one of two ways. And it has gone the good way. It has gone the heavenly way. I think I've been here now for 7 days. I've covered a lot of ground in this state. I've had a wonderful time. I very much understand the path for an ordinary man becoming Florida man. And what I wanted to share with you before the year ended was a conversation I had, I think about 10 days ago, with Pete Kanonitz from Free Man Beyond the Wall. Please be sure to check the show notes to find out more about Pete's show, how to follow him on Twitter and Instagram, and he's definitely worth following. I really enjoy the conversations we've had. But this show came about because Pete and I had talked back in April about where we thought the year was heading. And I have, you know, over the course of the last month or so, been reflecting on what I have to admit in many cases was some poor emotional and mental performance this year. And there are various reasons for that. Andrew and I have actually resumed the discomfort zone. We just put out our first episode since March, but a much deeper story about my 2020 is there, and you can get access to it at patreon.com/schoolsucks or through schoolsucksproject.com/AV to see all of our support options. The feedback that that show has generated has just been incredible, coming from all directions. Conversation, it was over 2 hours long. We recorded it in the very car that I'm sitting in right now. A big part of it is explaining the fallout that Andrew, one of my closest friends in the whole world, Andrew and I had earlier this year, and what was behind it and how we resolved it. But I only hinted those things in this public conversation with Pete, and we're comparing and contrasting where we were at the end of April to where we were basically at the end of December, and I really, really appreciated the conversation. So the title was a reference to what I thought was a pretty decent turn of phrase that I had, I think, midway through the conversation about government's role in the COVID response, but it also speaks to something else that we get into. What are, at this point, the tools that people are willing to consider using in moving the philosophy of liberty forward in this world? So like Pete has been talking about this, Dave Smith has been talking about this, and I wanted to hear Pete's perspective. It's a little different. I'm more reluctant about some of the things that he says, but I wanted to get it on the record and respond to it. And of course, I'm always interested in your feedback as well. And this conversation is pretty fiery. It has some cynicism in it. It's going to be one of the last political conversations that I ever put into our main RSS feed. And I thought the reflection on what's happened, what's changed, where we were right, where we were wrong, that was a conversation worth having and worth sharing as the year wraps up here. So again, remember to check out Pete's work, freemanbeyondthewall.com. And there's a lot to look forward to in 2021 from us here at School Sucks Project, so please stay tuned. I also know we've had a bit of a run here without a show. It doesn't mean there hasn't been shows. About half all the content we produce is, at this point, for members and supporters only. I'm headed back up north tomorrow, and hopefully we'll be ready to roll with new shows next week. And I'm glad I could sneak this in today so I could wish you a happy new year, and I'll see you in 2021. Take care. Don't call me taking your house, running down from the door. Don't call me taking your house, running down from the door. If I was of the greatest generation, I'd be pest surveying the world that I built. Slipping back into this, I'd be screaming at my grandkids. We already did this. Be suspicious of simple answers. That shit's for fascists and maybe teenagers. You can't fix the world if all you have is a hammer. The first time it was a tragedy, the second time it's a farce. Outside it's 1933, so I'm hitting the bar. And I don't know what's going on anymore. The wall outside is burning with a brand new light, but it isn't one that makes me feel warm. Don't call me taking your house, running down from the dawn. Don't call me taking your house, running down from the dawn.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Pete Quiñones. I invited Brett Bonnat to return to the show. Brett is the creator and the host of the School Sucks podcast. He has been on the show before, and part of the reason why he's coming on today is because we did an episode back in April where we talked about what we thought this year was going to be like in relation to COVID-19, and we wanted to do an end of the year and look at what we got right, what we got wrong, and look at strategy going forward. Brett is brilliant. He's going to have some great insights that you're going to like a lot. And we always have a spirited discussion, and it's very open and more conversational than interview-like. So enjoy this. Without any further delay, here's Brett Bonnat. I think I checked, and I think we talked on April 25th. And we both listened to back to the conversation. And let me start with this, okay, because this was something that stood out to me that I didn't remember, was that you were very much, you talked about the fact that how serious you were taking the virus and everything like that, and you had even said that it would be good, like, optics if people weren't going all the way in one direction or all the way in the other, and especially as, like, denying or anti-mask or stuff like that. Has that Has that changed at all?
I want to try and be sympathetic, but it's harder to play along with all of this at this point because people are talking like it's March again. You know, they're like, oh, it's just we have to shut things down for a limited period of time to flatten the people are. It's almost like some kind of like people are being gaslit by the media they're watching. So
it's Groundhog's Day, man.
Yeah.
It's like the same thing over and over again.
So is this the show or are we about to do the show?
No, we're already talking, Dev.
Oh, this is the show. Great to be with you again, Pete.
I mean, most of the time when I do stuff like this, I just try to do it informally. So, no big intro or anything like that. Like my friend Bird from Friends Against Government podcast, he's been on the show 12, 13 times. We just jump in. So you and I have talked enough times where it's like, we're just going to jump in. So, so gaslit, I mean, that's a term I was using in March.
Right. Yeah. I couldn't believe the things that I was hearing people say. And this was just yesterday, like dealing with family members. Now, I saw my mom and, she's 71, cancer survivor, and she doesn't really, she's kind of at this point indifferent and a Fox News viewer. So she's kind of just like, this is BS and I'm tired of it. My dad, on the other hand, wearing masks outside, they passed a law in New Hampshire, by the way.
Or an executive order.
Let's not call it a law. Good point. Good correction. A mandatory mask mandate in the live free or die state. So I guess you have to. I mean, it's not enforceable, and I didn't do it. I mean, I was outside just yesterday walking around. But yeah, if you're outside, you're supposed to have a mask on. And I think when it's funny, like I listened to that conversation in April, and I thought I was going to cringe a little bit at how my affect was. But it was clear then that the polarization was going to start, right? I was revisiting this book at the time called what's it called by Eric Foner, I think, or Eric Hofer, I don't remember. But it talks about the psychology of these movements. How I think when people feel like they're in a crisis or in danger, they're driven into these tribal situations. So that was one of the reasons why I was saying, like, don't go all the way or the other. I mean, I guess it depends on what you're trying to do. Are you trying to find people who are in your tribe and you want to say, yes, this is the right place for you to be? No masks, no shutdowns. Do you want to go hard that way? Or I certainly don't want to go hard the other way. But, if it is outreach and at least trying to plant seeds and to get people to think a little bit, then, geez, I would say trying to stake out some kind of middle ground, even if it's with the intention of taking a person somewhere else, ultimately, like, be an ally first and express some curiosity for where they're at and why and what they've seen and, go from there. Some of the places that I've seen people in and just kind of like thinking where I was in March, like I started out in a really bad position with this whole thing. And I think when we talked last time at the end of April, I just had this conversation with Tom Woods and he's like, I'm over it. And it actually kind of opened up a new way of thinking about it for me. I did a series shortly after we talked called This Is a Test with a friend of mine in Hawaii, who's a natural medicine practitioner named Daryl Becker. He's actually done a lot of productions about this over the course of the last year, where we just wanted to like basically demonstrate some critical thinking and some skepticism about this whole thing and like actually publicly go through a process of doing that. So that actually shifted my position a little bit too. But I have to, it is a time to reflect on the year. And I would say that in many cases, I feel like I performed poorly, mentally and emotionally in this situation. I made some hasty decisions that were costly. The last time I talked to you, I was in an Airbnb in the middle of nowhere in New Hampshire.
I remember.
Yeah. And I was thinking I was going to watch the whole world burn, that month, that April, and nothing.
And that happened. Was it. That, and that was at the end of April.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what's funny is only a couple days after that, Tom came up here to Atlanta and we went out to a restaurant and ate.
Right.
That was on May 1st.
Yeah. I think my first back in a restaurant was like sometime in June, Yeah, 2 weeks after we talked, and I'm held up in this place and thinking this is it and glad to be somewhere safe. 2 weeks after we talked, I was back in Pittsburgh. getting ready to move out of there and move back to New Hampshire. So yeah, there were definitely a lot of hasty decisions, and I think a lot of it was emotionally driven. And you know, being able to put that space between stimulus and response in a novel situation is really important. Like, we talk about that on my show all the time, right? The space between stimulus. I learned it from Richard Grove. He used to talk about that on his podcast all the time. You know, there's this opportunity in between where most people, and we see this on the news, we see people in social media just having like these debates almost like they're reading scripts to each other, right? They're just, and if you come in and create a pattern interruption and say, well, what about this? They ignore you. They act like you're not even, they have to edit it out of their reality. So with all this happening and seeing that polarization, I think we also started to, with the mask stuff, understand that there was something, it felt like something was coming. That's why I brought up that mass movements book, where, you know, people are pushed apart, but they're trying to find someplace safe. And if it means going to extremes, then we go to extremes. We even hinted at like racial tension in that show. I think it first occurred to me when I was back in Pittsburgh the next month, and they were trying to make a story out of that jogger who got shot by two guys. And I remember saying on a podcast in May, like, this could be the thing that sets everything off. This could be the thing. But then, you know, like George Floyd was 2 weeks later, and that was that was certainly the thing. So, yeah.
Well, that in between you're talking about, mm-hmm. that's where I am in my head. But you know, I have made mistakes this year, and most of the mistakes that I've made, I have an article coming out tomorrow that'll talk about it, was in a situation like this, you want to be proactive. You want to be proactive and not reactive. And every time I made a mistake, it was being reactive. You know, it was just reacting to whatever was being thrown in my direction. And I've gotten to the point now where I'm walking in the middle in my own life, but I can operate on either side. Because my strategy, I've developed a strategy this year, and the strategy forces me to be able to go to one side or to the other when I'm talking to people.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions about that. First of all, what was a place where you felt like you were reactive, if you don't mind sharing?
Quitting the Libertarian Party because of their lack of messaging on this was just a reaction on my point. And I think it was a mistake, because there are a lot of allies in there that I should have relied on and I should have been able to help this year, given support this year. Instead, I ignored them. And another was just totally defaulting to saying the only thing that can take us out of this is agorism. The only mm-hmm. thing that's going to take us out, the only way through this is agorism. And it was a reaction, and it was a mistake. And I actually think that it's probably the most important thing we still have, because we're not out of the woods on this yet. I still believe that COVID passports and things like that, it's going to be agorists who are going to be able to counterfeit them and get them for us, for the people who don't want vaccines, you know, who, yeah, I'll tell you when we're not recording what I'm going to be doing with the vaccine wise. Cause you know, yeah, you gotta have a plan. And, so yeah, there were some things that I just reacted to this year that, if I had a chance to take it back, I would have been more riding the middle on it than the way that I acted.
So now when you talk about like going to one place or the other, like what are situations like that? Because I feel like one of the things that I think we talked about in April that I was starting to realize is if I saw people being really cavalier, like the thing that happened at the Michigan State House, that would almost like push me. Like we were at the point where I was kind of getting over the extreme caution. And I mean, I'm a guy who like, I have some health anxiety. This wasn't a good thing for that. There was the stories they were telling us, like it sits on surface for 7 days. You know, it's airborne. It can be passed asymptomatically. Like all of these things that have been deeply debated or entirely dismissed at this time. Like it was scary. And I guess looking at my own like health anxiety that obviously waxes and wanes and, you know, is triggered by different things. There was no preparation that I did for something like this. So thinking that it was like by late March going to drive all like societal collapse and that this could be like a long-term illness. It's like, well, I don't want to get sick and have to deal with a societal collapse. It was funny. Like, wasn't the show's fault. Certainly wasn't your fault. That day after we recorded, so end of April, I do another podcast, this comedy podcast with my friends, and we get into a fight about this because they say like, oh, everything's going back to normal in like two weeks. And I say, things are not going back to normal. This isn't getting anywhere. It's going to go worse. It's going to get worse. And then there were some judgments made and passed back and forth once things got a little bit heated. And me and my friends wound up not talking to each other for months over this. So I became one of these, I mean, it's all better now, but I became one of these people who like ends friendships over something that at that point had been totally politicized, at least temporarily I did. Cause I was just so aggravated with like, why is nobody listening to me that this is a big deal? But also at that point over the sort of panic and hysteria of it. I mean, I was up in the middle of nowhere and I felt pretty safe and, you know, I had just, bought a new gun to have. So I was, you know, I was storing food.
I bought a couple this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bought a couple new guns this year.
It was funny. Like right before I talked to you, when I was going up to that place, so this was like the end of the March. I'm in New Hampshire. I call a gun store in New Hampshire and I say, is there a place where I can see what your inventory is online? The guy goes, we have no inventory. We have no guns here. He said, you can come in tomorrow and maybe there'll be some. But that was scary. And I did manage to get my hands on one to have in New Hampshire because I still lived in Pittsburgh. Like I left reactive, right? I left when everything shut down March 13th. I have a network of people here. There were people that I care about here. There were reasons for me to be here. I packed up my car and I left, you know, and I didn't go home for months, you know, thinking that the entire city was going to burn. So a little of it burned. But, you know, I certainly overestimated. But I guess it's nice that 2020 happened because now we know, you know, our limitations. We know our weaknesses. I mean, I was listening to Part of the Problem to kind of download. I thought Dave would do a good job of like downloading into my mind what was going on, at least this week, because I was just completely blacked out on news, social media, just as an experiment, just for a month. Why not? Didn't affect my work too much. I got other things I can talk about and, you know, besides what's going on in the news. And I thought it was interesting how he was saying, like, they keep being wrong about things. And I don't want to get super conspiratorial here, but like, you know, Fauci comes out and says something, the CDC comes out and says something, the WHO comes out and says something, and then it's proven to be wrong. So all of these people at that point, when they're wrong about something, or they say, you know, like, travel on Thanksgiving and die on Christmas, like these kinds of messages, and then these things don't happen. Everybody who's lining up against that, and I think Tucker Carlson is kind of like a Pied Piper for this, and I'm not saying he's up to no good, but they kind of do a victory lap, right? They go out in public and they do a victory lap, like, see, all these people don't know anything. They don't know what they're talking about. And there's a larger dialectic here that these people are basically falling into an I told you so honeypot of, what if this does get worse somehow, or it's at least purported to be worse once the United States government changes administrations in January. If they want to push harder on this, they've got a nice collection of people who've been out in the open saying, oh, this is no big deal. This is overblown. And if they can present it to be worse than it already is, they're going to make all those people look like fools. Right. And that doesn't even require it being worse. They control the narrative on this is so controlled. You know, when I was talking about that gaslighting thing, it's almost like they can come out and say and do whatever they want and make those people look like, you know, complete dangerous fools who don't care about the health of, you know, anybody in this country. So that's actually something that I'm worried about, that and that's why I talked about like kind of staking out a middle ground or quietly observing before speaking. And obviously we don't live in like a media environment or a social media environment that really lends itself to being patient, you know, in making assessments about these things. But I do worry that people in their criticism of like, oh, this is hysteria, it's overblown, that they're kind of exposing themselves in a way that might come back to bite them. Yeah, somebody in the chat says a new strain would do exactly that. And that's kind of what I'm worried about. So whether it's synthetic or real, and then there's all kinds of questions to get into there. And that happens early next year. I mean, I think at one point we were thinking, yeah, like Trump leaves office and all this goes away. But this is endlessly useful. This is endless. This is 9/11 every day, right?
Yep. We talked about that on the last episode, how we were comparing it to 9/11, and I was already saying that, you know, it was going to go way beyond 9/11. It's, you know, as much as I knew that this was going to be an opportunity for quote unquote them, I didn't know that it would go this long. And I guess what they had to count on was the buy-in from a good portion of the population. And a good, you know, it seems to go down party lines up to a certain point. Now I don't really see it down party lines. I see that one may be more evangelical about it. I think the left is more evangelical about it. The right is going along to get along. This is basically somebody, a bunch of interest groups saying, we've got this opportunity and we have to run with it. And all the changes you're seeing, just basically the stock market to me is being up over 30,000 is theft. It's just enriching certain people. They'll pull out, they'll crash it at some point. All the people who have 401ks, it'll be decimated. This is just unsustainable. They are fundamentally tearing down horrible institutions and systems, and they're going to replace it with something even worse.
I think that's possible. Have you heard Grand Theft World podcast yet? Rich's podcast? Okay, yeah. So you've been listening to that. So obviously, we know for everything there is designs. Often designs are in place before the thing that requires the design actually happens. That's nothing new. This has been going on in the United States since the 1800s, at least. So then there are questions about, like, yes, know the designs, understand it. I think they're doing a really good job on Grand Theft World putting puzzle pieces together. And then it comes down to the question is, what is the power of implementation that these people have? Well, in a crisis, we know, especially when it is supported by massive amounts of public fear, which can be like turned up and down with a dial. I mean, we see, like, all right, so here's an interesting thing I noticed. When they wanted people to vote from home, So there was a story. This is where I should start the story, where the CDC released an article on their website and then took it down, saying that the COVID, that the virus is airborne, right, and can spread through the air, and then pulled it down and put it right back up right before the election. Which I don't know. I'm just asking questions. There's no conclusion in there. It's just when you have 1,000 things like this to add together and just at least try to decide how skeptical you should be. I thought that was interesting. So it's almost like just putting something out there that this is from the CDC. This is about your health. Let's turn that dial up right now. So like between social media and mainstream media, there's just a lot of ability to control people's response to this. So if the fear is turned up, I think people are going to become more desperate and more accepting of what we would consider in America to be extreme solutions. So, we're watching celebrities right now who, for the most part, are just thoughtless billboards for whatever, you know, a safe and acceptable opinion is, getting, you know, the vaccine. They're like taking the shots on camera and posting it on social media. I mean, that just looks... I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but that just seems stupid with something that was rolled out so quick that the long-term effects are unknown. But again, it's one of those polarized positions where people don't, that, you know, they're so echo chambered that they're just like, I'm on the side of science. Science isn't wrong. The people who are on the other side of science are, you know, at Trump rallies in Butler, Pennsylvania, acting like idiots, you know, super spreading. So yeah, I don't know. I think that's interesting to watch, that people are using these heuristics to not even think about this. And that I think is part of the function, or part of, it's a feature of this tribalization, that once there's safety in a group, you know, right, once there's that identity, nobody is thinking for themselves anymore. Not like they were doing a great job before either, in many cases. And it's hard to talk about this without sounding like an elitist, like talking about everybody else. But gosh, I just wish people were more curious, especially like 9 months into this thing. I just wish people at this point would be saying, geez, maybe not everything on the news is right. And maybe not go blasting it and parading around like, oh, see, it's all BS. But just be more skeptical in their own decision making. You know, just know that there could be a space between stimulus and response.
Well, the celebrities, I mean, all that is advertising. They're advertising a product.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's just purely what it is. I mean, it's pure Bernays. I mean, mm-hmm. remember, I'm sure Richard talks about, what do they call them? Freedom torches back when
cigarettes.
They wanted to get, yeah, freedom, women to smoke, mm-hmm. you know, because women up until the 1910s and that area, they didn't really, it was looked down upon if they smoked. So how do you get women to smoke? Oh, they're freedom torches, you know, pure Bernays.
Right. And it was tied up with the women's, they were called freedom torches because it was tied up with the women's suffrage movement, that it was right. like an empowering thing for women to do what men do. And it sells cigarettes for the cigarette companies. Oh, Bernays is, man, he has a lot of really good examples.
I've learned
the world safe for democracy. That was Bernays, World War One.
I've learned so much from him, man. It's so, and if you know what you're doing after you read him, you can start implementing that on your own.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One of the recurring shows that I do on School Sucks is actually called Emotional Manipulators for Hire. So it's like a monthly series that I do with my friend Nathan Fraser. Have you ever run into him? He's a copywriter. He's the Facebook world champion. He is the best troll that I've ever seen on Facebook. He's like the Michael Malice of Facebook. So Nathan and I, we talk about this double-edged sword of, you know, marketing versus manipulation. And, you know, I guess it's more like, you know, our side is a butter knife and their side is a chainsaw, more than a double-edged sword. But understanding the things that are done to you and like and then being able to repurpose them for good, I think that's a really important intellectual self-defense, form of knowledge to have. So, yeah, that's obviously one of the features that I do. But yeah, you're right. It's like once you see these things and you know, and this is what it's a shame, Pete, because I like 10 years ago, I felt like I was saying things like, this is all just possible because people don't know logical fallacies. If people learned logical fallacies, then none of this stuff would work. I was so wrong about that. I had so much faith and certainly didn't see the way that social media would be able to distort all of this and shortcut people's thinking in so many ways where people literally don't even care anymore. They want to be lied to if it's what they want to hear.
Yeah. The way I'm looking at this is I've just come to the conclusion that it's war. Mm-hmm. That they've basically declared war on us.
Yeah.
And if they've declared war on us, then I'm not going to run and hide. And just building strategies for doing it. That's why I can go back and forth and be a complete anti-masker and be pro-mask, because I think what needs to happen is the only solution to this is radical decentralization and even secession, breaking into the Overton window. I mean, if it's not on the news at night, then it's not truth or it doesn't exist. It has to be broadcasted on one of those stations that people think are, you know, First Amendment, you know, endorsed news stations. And the only thing that I see right now is that an even greater wedge needs to be driven between those radicals on the left and the right of out there until the point where it gets so dangerous for the average person that people are going to start calling for divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing that I see, the only way forward, because is you're going to have to change the culture. If you don't change the culture, nothing is going to be changed politically.
And it's going to have to change at those edges. Like that's going to be the driving force behind the change. You know, it's real easy to, and I think I've already done it in this conversation, to say something like things are so polarized, but remember on September 12th, 2001, when they weren't, what a disaster that was. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely see the advantage of that. And if we actually want to bring about change, and there are, you know, people in our world who have said this thing, like, what the hell would we do with unity right now? Imagine with these designs, if there was a unified, fearful public, my goodness, what a horror show.
Well, there's already too many. There's already too high a percentage that is unified on this in order to fight back. So it has to be divided. You have to start dividing it. You have to start dividing them. You have to start breaking them up, because as long as they're unified, you know, I think that 10% of the people, I mean, because you see it. I mean, progressivism since the early 1900s has been a fraction of the population, but it's been the leadership. and the leadership has gotten enough people behind progressivism to basically now we are a center left and center right progressive country as far as politics goes. And the only way to break that up is you're going to have something is going to happen to the population as far as, hey, we need to split up in order to be safe or even something like that. I mean, I would hope that it wouldn't come to something like that, but I don't see any other way, especially when you look at this past summer and all the riots and everything. And, you know, that happened after we talked in April, obviously. And I was learning every single day watching that on TV. I was just watching it on TV and taking notes and going, okay. Mm-hmm. This is what needs to be done. This is what needs to be done.
Yeah. You remind me the book that I mentioned a couple times about mass movements. It's called The True Believer, and it's definitely worth at least finding a Cliff's Notes version of it and kind of aligning it with where your thinking has been, because it was even written like over 50 years ago. I mean, I think it's only up through like the end of World War II, but you know, he lays out like rules based on his observations as a historian, like over at least the first half of the 20th century. And it was a good predictive resource for where things were headed. I mean, even, you know, I remember being in Pittsburgh in March and trying to make this decision the week before I left and sitting out on my porch and going, yeah. I mean, I lived in like a nice kind of Mr. Rogers neighborhood. And, you know, I knew a few of my neighbors and it's a really friendly city. But I looked at a map, you know, to look at the demographics and the crime statistics in the surrounding neighborhoods and thinking like, how long can these people not work for? How, or if these people get some kind of government benefits, how long could they do without them? And then what do they do? And, you know, I sat on my porch and I looked at all the houses up and down my street. I said, I don't know those people. And, you know, with the Free State Project, I have a huge network of people in New Hampshire. So that seems like even if I'm like abandoning the School Sucks podcast studio and all of my personal belongings, hopefully I'll see them again. But yeah, I mean, it really seemed like things were going to go that way. I just didn't know how they were going to get there. And then by the time I talked to you and I looked at that book, I was like, geez, it could be any, if this goes on long enough, if this goes on for another month, it could be anything. And anyway, we thought the mask thing was going to set it off back in April. Like people were going to get violent over that.
Oh, they adopted it. It's clothing now.
What do you mean?
The masks.
The mask is clothing.
It's just another piece of clothing. It's just a piece of, and what it is, it's like you're covering up your unmentionables.
Mm.
It's pretty much what it's like. It's almost like panties or underwear.
Yeah. And I think it's definitely been talked about, like the Stanford Prison Experiment. Do you know the Stanford Prison Experiment? I'm sure you're probably familiar with
that. We talked about that.
I guess I didn't. I had cut part of the show that I was going to repost. So I only listened to that part. So that's great. Yeah. Covering up parts of your face is like a dehumanizing or depersonalizing thing. And that also the implications of that were pretty foreboding back then as well. So sure. But for people who didn't hear that, it's just like in the Stanford Prison Experiment, they made the guards who they wanted to be mean to the prisoners in the experiment. It was all kind of like a role play, wear dark sunglasses. So you couldn't go eye to eye with people. And that created a kind of barrier, the same way tribes would decorate themselves and hide their identity in war paint before they'd kill each other. So interestingly enough, we're down in your old stomp, not where you lived, but in your city of New York. I was down there with Rich a couple weeks ago. We took a U-Haul truck. No, yeah. It was, I mean, it was an experience of a lifetime. I'm really,
I was there in September.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
It's sad. That city is destroyed. And I know crime is up there. Murder is up there like 400%. And so I drive a U-Haul truck into the city, Manhattan, Upper West Side, to go to John Taylor Gatto's apartment and collect all his books before it changes ownership at the end of the year. So we had a crew of 8 people and I was outside. I was still being cautious enough, Pete, that I didn't want to go into a Manhattan apartment building because I had a lot of like travel coming up and people I had to see. So if there was I went up once because I needed to like experience, like this was John Taylor Gatto's life. This is one of the most important people in, you know, my development and what I do. And for people who don't know, Gatto was a really well-respected teacher, New York Teacher of the Year, and he was the one who actually started blowing the whistle on a lot of the problems with the public education system. But he backed it up with tremendous research, and he wrote this book called The Underground History of American Education. Our friend Richard Grove, that we keep talking about, made a documentary in 2011 or 2012 called The Ultimate History Lesson, where he brought Gatto to his house and interviewed him for an entire weekend. So when this opportunity presented itself, and I happened to be like, you know, I was going to New York to see friends, not New York City, but I was going to something in upstate New York. I jumped on the opportunity to do this. So last time we talked, I'm hiding in a cabin in the middle of nowhere in New Hampshire. And if you had told me, Brett, next time we talk, you're going to tell me you went to Manhattan in a truck, you know, to pay and go into apartment buildings, I wouldn't have believed you back in April. But we did it. We drove in. We had a crew of eight guys that helped with this process, just shuttling, you know, banker's boxes full of books. And we filled the U-Haul truck with this stuff. His book collection was amazing. It was so eclectic. And he had a lot of like really interesting things. And he had like, I found a copy of his book, The Underground History, in Russian. I thought that was, I found a copy of a book called Dumbing Us Down in German. I thought these were interesting things to find. So, yeah, the city just feels very, very eerie. And so I'm sitting outside waiting for the next load to come down as I'm packing the truck. And this man just walks by without a mask, smiling. And this should be, you know, a regular occurrence in human life, you would think. But this man stuck out like he was a ghost or something, right? Like he was just so out of a man with his face out and a smile on it. And he walks up to me, and there was another guy there with me packing the truck, and he goes, "You guys moving in?" And I said, "Sir, nobody moves into Manhattan. The whole city is just a parade of U-Haul trucks, by the way, like leaving. Like there's U-Haul trucks everywhere, people packing up apartments." So we're double parked on, you know, one of the number streets, like a tight little number street on the Upper West Side. And that was a hassle, but again, worth it. And I talked to this guy for a couple minutes, and I just had to say, like, you know, it's nice to see another smiling face, because it was the only one I saw in a city of millions of people. I didn't see them all, but every other person masked, head down. It's just so dystopian there.
When was this?
I want to say December 7th or 8th, December 8th. We were there.
I was there third week in September, and there was, I stayed on Lower East Side, and there was a lot of people walking around without masks on.
Oh, good. Yeah. This was the only guy I saw.
Yeah. There was a lot of people. Now, the scariest part was going up to Times Square at 11:30 on a Tuesday, and it's a ghost town. That's the, that's the part where you're just like, that's the part that was messed up. But I've actually flown four times in the last 3 months, 2.5 months.
Yeah.
And, Texas, place in Georgia, down New York, down in Florida. Florida was the most open compared to here. New York was obviously insane. Jekyll Island wasn't bad at all. That area wasn't bad at all.
Oh, did you get a red pill?
I was there that weekend. There was a Mises event going on, and I was there that weekend. And I would have went over to Red Pill if Richard was there, but Richard wasn't there. But Ed had come over and visited for, I think, on Friday morning. He had stopped in.
Oh, that's such an interesting subject, too. I got a chance to talk to G. Edward Griffin maybe like 2 months ago. He was on this show called Union of the Unwanted that Ricky Verandis puts together from the Ripple Effect. Sure. So we're on a panel. There's like 20 people there, and one of them is just G. Edward Griffin in the center square, right? So I forget what we were talking about, but I had a chance to like interject on something that he was saying, and I thanked him for this amazing interview that he did in like 1984. It was in 1984 with this guy Yuri Bezmenov. Have you ever seen that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Yuri Bezmenov, for people who don't know, is a KGB defector who worked in subversion. And he's telling G. Edward Griffin, and as far as the Russians are concerned, the Soviets are concerned in 1984. Yeah. He's like, our whole project is done here. We come here, we do demoralization. It whatever it takes to educate a generation of people, we effectively demoralize them and prepare them for Marxism, you know, and then we create destabilization, you know, through the politics and through the culture. And once things are effectively demoralized and destabilized, we produce a crisis. And once there's a crisis, we promote normalization. So I'm looking at Yuri Bezmenov's KGB subversion playbook, this year, right? It was in content that we did. We did a show about it called How Usefully Idiotic Are We? A couple months ago. And I play this Bezmenov thing. And this is what they've, I'm not blaming the Russians. I know that was a big thing last year and the year before. But somebody's using a very, very similar kind of playbook. And it seems to, like, even though the demoralization started a long time ago, could have even started with the Soviets, as far as Marxism is concerned. But, you know, Trump was the destabilizing force in a lot of ways, right? He really, again, not that it's all bad, not that there's no side benefits of this, but created a lot of division and destabilization. And in comes the crisis. And I would say right now it looks like we're in a period of normalization, right? So do we go back to crisis and then get a new normal after that? I don't know. But I'm really interested in what you're saying. And I know hope is a strange word to use, but I'm really interested in what you're saying about balkanization, because obviously it needs to happen. And obviously, if there was ever a time, this is it. I mean, I think with all the blackpilling that's going on right now, one thing that actually gives me a lot of optimism is the government has never come up and knocked on your front door, right? So like when I was involved in like Ron Paul revolutions 10, 12 years ago, and I'm complaining about all this, like the TSA, people are saying, what are you talking about, dude? Like things are fine here. You could be in China, you know? And now I think that kind of message has to resonate with more people. More people, as frustrated as I am with the lack of curiosity that I see, more people have to be curious now. More people have to be skeptical now as this stuff comes more and more into their faces. And as more people continue to experience their ability to make a living interfered with by mandates and shutdowns and quarantines and whatever, yeah, I mean, people are going to start exploring gray markets, black markets. They're going to have to if this keeps going. So in addition to, well, I guess against feeling sympathetic, because I do feel somewhat sympathetic to the black pill position, I also, as far as I'm concerned, as far as our world is concerned, and as far as like the average person in this country is concerned, I think there is still room for optimism here. And more people may be just getting frustrated and turning away from this when they see that the government solutions are, it's the same thing over and over again, and things just get worse, right? Like when all you have is a hammer, eventually you destroy everything. And that's kind of what we're seeing. So I think there is a greater opportunity than ever for, I hate to say something as cliche as wake up, but for people to get real curious and start asking questions. And that's a great place for people to be. And I think that's part of our job, is not to, throw conclusions at people. I don't think either of us really do that, but to, as media creators, model at least asking questions, you know, and maybe that plants some seeds and maybe something grows, because this is the time when it has to happen.
I have an announcement to make. Some people said they want to support the show, but they don't want to support Patreon. So I set up a Subscribestar account. It has everything and all the levels that are on Patreon. If you go to freemanbeyondthewall.com/SSS, there is a link to my Subscribestar, or you can go to Subscribestar and just search Free Man Beyond the Wall. Of course, you can always support me on Patreon at patreon.com/Mance Raider. Also, paypal.me/Mance Raider. And you can support me on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store, where you can do it for crypto or you can do it for fiat. Thank you very much.
Something that I've been doing over the past few weeks, and it's gotten a good response. And it's not only me, it's Dave Smith and other people, Angela McArdle, who was just on my show on Friday. We're talking about those people who want to call themselves libertarians, ANCAPs, whatever they want to call themselves. The time for, here, read this book, and oh, aren't we so consistent, is over.
It's so over.
Those days are over, and people need to radicalize. And if they don't get radical at this point, then they're useless to me. And I don't have time for them. I don't have use for them.
Well, our mode of operation the entire time I've been involved in this, and I think this is true for maybe people in the left and in the right as well, but certainly in the libertarian world, right? Our whole thing, or a big part of our whole thing, has been when X happens, people will realize they were wrong about Y. That's over. right?
There's no logic. There's no more logic, no more reason. When you're talking to people, you almost have to talk in riddles. You have to talk in magic. You have to talk in a language. You have to figure out what language they're dealing with, because I would say 99 out of 100 people that you're talking to don't know what the word consistency means. Don't know what logic is. Don't know what reason is anymore. Mm-hmm. So you have to find a way to talk to them. And that's pretty much the hardest thing. And the one thing that the one way I can talk to them is to talk to them about what the hell's happening to them and that they really need to get mad. And if they're not getting mad and they're not trying to figure out what needs to be done, I mean, to go on the offensive against, you know, this, you know, I started using the term medical industrial complex because, I mean, that's what it is at this point. It's no different than the military industrial complex. It is, we're going to do whatever we want. The money that's being stolen from you is given directly to us, and people just need to get mad. I mean, people need to figure out, join up with other people and try to figure out how to, you know, lob metaphorical bombs at the government, the media, and the colleges and the universities, because they're all working together and they need to be delegitimized.
What does the delegitimization look like to you?
Well, I mean, it's what Trump started in the last 4 years, mm-hmm. where you have a certain section of this country who just looks at anything coming from the progressive wing, the progressive left wing. You know, a lot of people don't understand that Fox News, for the most part, is the progressive right wing, you know, mm-hmm. except for a couple of their talking heads in the evening. But right. at least they understand. And, you know, and what's funny is after Fox News called it for Biden, like the next day after the election, you saw a lot of these people abandoning Fox. So yep. you have a population in this country of tens of millions of people who don't trust the press, think that the universities are teaching communism to their kids, which they are, and think that the government is corrupt and that the election was stolen from them. What mm-hmm. better pool of people to go after than that?
Well, the outreach question, with such a need to do like operating in my own sphere of control kind of work, like outreach has always been appealing as an idea, but how much resource do we devote to it? And maybe not you and me, but just like anybody who would be listening to this and kind of be sympathetic to this message. How many resources, like mental and emotional, have you devoted to outreach, and what has it yielded you? Like lately, it's gotten very, very difficult. We pursued a bad strategy of when people experience X, they'll realize they were wrong about Y, right? It's kind of like the McLuhan idea that the medium is the message, right? Means of communication now prohibit people from being able to like thoughtfully engage with new ideas, while algorithms forcefully, reinforce what they already believe. Almost like they'd be startled that somebody could, believe the opposite on something and be allowed to drive a car or would know how to dress themselves with a completely opposite viewpoints on what is clearly sane and rational. Here, like people get there.
Let me give you here's what I would do is if I'm engaging somebody one-on-one, mm-hmm. the first thing I want to know is, have they swallowed a bottle of blue pills? Because if they've swallowed a bottle of blue pills, I'm wasting my time. Just walk away,
How do you test for that?
Ask them, when do you plan on taking the mask off?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if they say when the when I get the vaccine, they're blue pilled.
Yeah.
That's just blue pilled to me. Sorry. It just is. But there are people out there who haven't taken a whole red pill, but they've taken a good part of a red pill. And those are the people that need to be talked to. And those are the people that need to be reached out to. And, there's no better medium to do it on than social media. You just have to initiate a blitz and you have to figure out ways to do it. And that's something that I'm working with people on doing, is getting that message out there. And, my pet thing is going after the marriage of the universities, the press, and the forever state, the permanent administrative state. That marriage there, that's my thing.
The cathedral idea?
The cathedral,
Okay. So actually that brings us to an interesting turning point here. I know you had Curtis Yarvin on your show not too long ago. What attracted you to him? Because I've been going through some of his stuff too and trying to understand it a little bit better. What of his did you want to add to your presentation here? I'm just curious.
Okay, I read about a year ago, I read his article from 2007, Why I'm Not a Libertarian. Mm-hmm. And it didn't make any sense to me. And I went back to it when all of this started. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I read it in March. And I'm like, okay, I completely understand. And then he recommended reading the book, The Machiavellians. And after I read the book, The Machiavellians, I was just like, I went back and started reading some of his articles where he's specifically talking about political science. He's talking about political theory and everything. And I immediately said, this guy may be one of the greatest living political minds.
Yeah.
And because he understands political power, he understands the difference between political power, political force, and political violence. And how many people understand that? Mm-hmm. He's a great teacher, and he's somebody who, you know, ignore at your own peril, because he, you know, it's like people who refuse to read like Lenin and Trotsky.
Sure.
If you refuse to read Lenin and Trotsky, you are missing out on so much strategy that you can use in subversion, in propaganda.
And, well, yeah. If you're unfamiliar with them, the 20th century certainly wouldn't make a lot of sense.
No. I mean, people don't even understand that what happened with the Russian Revolution, what happened with World War I, fundamentally changed the world forever. Mm-hmm. It definitely changed Europe forever. I mean, you went from a land that was predominantly monarchies, and if they weren't monarchies, they were some kind of constitutional monarchy or parliamentary monarchy, and everything basically the whole chessboard got turned over, and now they're democracies. And I mean, I think Hans Hermann Hoppe has taught us you'd rather have a monarchy than you'd rather have a monarchy than a democracy.
So if there's that actually brings up another question. So if we identify a problem in libertarianism, it's that it requires like a really long-term Fabian strategy. Stefan Mullen used to talk about this all the time. And like Fabianism is a dirty word because we always associate it with socialism. But the Fabian strategy in libertarianism is that everybody has to be brought to an acceptance of the non-aggression principle, which I don't know. What does that take? 2000 years? We might have 12 months. we might have 12 months to get somewhere.
I've stopped talking about it. The non-aggression principle means absolutely nothing to me anymore.
I understand that. I definitely understand that position. And, you know, I'm still very philosophically supportive of those ideas. And I would love to be alive for a world like that. But I mean, the writing is on all the walls. The writing is on all the surfaces at this point.
It's like anarchism. You're not going to catch me doing an I put out a documentary on anarchism. Go watch that.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah, it was great.
Okay. Thank you. So if you want to learn about anarchism, go watch that. You're not going to. Why am I going to talk about it? You want to talk about the pipe dream of, if anything is I've learned in the last 9 months is the overwhelming majority of people don't want a libertarian society, and they certainly don't want anarchism. And they've basically been taught what anarchism is what happened in Seattle. With Chaz, Chop, whatever you want to call it, or what was happening on the streets for months, at least during the whole summer.
Yeah. And I mean, it also kind of exposes that political libertarianism is not a big enough picture, right? If you look at the theaters of freedom to pursue in one's life, right, in our finances, in our health, in our own mental health, in our relationships, in our work, like in all these different places, like libertarianism doesn't offer like an integral approach to that. So political libertarianism in a world where like all this other stuff, even like minarchism, never mind like anarcho-capitalism, in a world where people are still basically being driven into madness by, you know, the inability of their own brains to like deal with the technological environments that we live in. We're seeing this, right? We're seeing a lot of people's mental health break down, or at least contextually, like in those situations. People are not prepared for the kinds of interactions and information fire hoses that are getting sprayed in their face. And I don't even call it information, input, right? Information is a very generous word for what a lot
stimuli.
Of people... Yeah, stimuli, exactly. So this is my whole project. It's like no one's ever been educated. No one was ever educated to really do anything meaningful, but they certainly weren't educated to respond to this in an effective way as people. And it would be nice if people, and this is what School Sucks has been about for 12 years, is like, hey, here's a current that you're in that you don't know you're in, and it's taking you somewhere. And I think if we can make you aware of what the current is and where it takes you, and how all that works, that would be useful information. And one of the things that actually, like, I was encouraged, it got criticized a lot, but that film, The Social Dilemma, it's like, okay, this is a popular documentary that's actually on ramping like a lot of left-wing people into thinking about these kinds of things. Because if you watch the trailer for this Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, they're kind of like, oh yeah, Trump wins because Facebook, Cambridge Analytica. But it's a current that everybody's in. So I was kind of hoping, you know, Matt Taibbi did something similar. He's another kind of left-wing, you know, he's an investigative journalist. He's done some crappy things, but I think he has some integrity. And I think he's definitely like iconoclastic in some really important places. You know, he has this book called Hate Incorporated. So you take these two ideas and you say, okay, can these things effectively on-ramp mainstream people from the low roads of like CNN or Real Time with Bill Maher, wherever those places are, can it make them hungry and curious for like a better information superhighway? I know I didn't coin that phrase, but like, can it take them to a higher place where they're actually like moving towards information in an empowered and purposeful way just by this realization, like, yeah, these algorithms run your life in a lot of ways. This is a current you're in. Do you want to know about more currents? And I think that's a useful kind of integral project to figure out is like, you know, it's marketing. Like, if you like The Social Dilemma, you might like this. You might like to learn about the 15,000 hours you spent being educated by the government. You know, maybe the overlap between those two things is small, but at least that these on-ramps exist, I think is also something that's fairly encouraging. So I still think, while I totally agree, and this is something that I spent time on too recently, talking about agorism, we did a show called The Path to Panarchy, where this great website called Integral World, and this guy, Brian O'Doherty, wrote this very long piece about panarchy as being like you're familiar with the concept, obviously, right? You talk about it in the documentary. Okay. So like multiple forms of government existing simultaneously, unbound to geography is basically the idea. So this is something that agorism would have to make possible. There would have to be some kind of counter-economic system to do this. So there is a lot of volatility, a lot of crisis. Those situations always produce opportunity. I was at this gathering of friends. This dude says to me, the primary project right now is preserving your own sanity. I was like, damn, that's dark, but powerful. And I agree with you. Like your mind is obviously your most important tool. So I would really like to see more people putting energy and attention there, whether they're in our world or they're, you know, the people out there. People's attention gets so sucked out of them into all this stuff that they can't do anything about, you know?
Yeah.
So you just have people who hate each other and feel no power. So the only thing they can do is continue to tribalize and hate people who aren't their tribe. But it doesn't mean a cynical way to end that paragraph, but I do think there is hope.
We're at a moment in history where, and we talked about this, where logic doesn't exist, reason doesn't exist, and you just have people basically worshiping at the altar of the state. But worst, you know, we've been talking about that forever, that people worship at the altar of the state. What has happened this year? This year, COVID is a religion. People don't want to accept that, but it is a religion and it has a narrative. And in order for, you know, a religion has to have a narrative, has to have a central narrative.
Yeah.
And it's a religion.
And I think people have almost lost the plot at this point, because obviously there was a lot of motivation to tie it to Trump. Right. I don't think this is a controversial thing to say, even if it was just an impulse. And for a lot of people, it never came above the subconscious. It's like, Trump is president. I hate America. This is the worst thing that's ever happened. Great. Here's something that will ruin it. You know, and here's something that he can be blamed for. It crashed a fairly good economy. I mean, yes, we've all been telling people for 20 years that our economy is not going to be great forever, but it was good at the beginning of this year, right? So it crashes that. It takes away Trump's best asset for winning the election. And then every day, even though for a while, like, I thought he was doing a good job, like he was making use of it. He was going out, he was looking very presidential, right? He's basically making campaign ads, doing those press conferences. I felt like he was being really, you know, measured, really like the kind of, in the Trump soap opera, I think one of the things that pulls you in, or pulled me in, a lot of people are just there for the hate, but it's like, I want to see him do the right thing. I want to see him be an adult. I want him to surprise me, you know, and that was like the closest I ever got to it. But a lot of people gained a lot of momentum, right? And a lot of buy-in, like you call it a religion. People got very religious about how this can destroy Trump. Jettison Trump, and they still might just go with it, right? If it means if it means punishing the people who went to some Trump rally somewhere, or people who won't wear masks, or people who have questions, it's useful beyond Trump. Yeah, I think that's the thing that, you know, Trump, it kind of drafted on Trump hatred for a while, but it can probably go on its own now. And I think that's a good point, that it has at this point just become, because there's no reason. And because there's certainly a lot of enemy imagery. There is that, this religion or this tribe, moving against finding. It was kind of like what we talked about back in April, how like you can kind of ping pong just by seeing, oh, that person's being like a little too cavalier, and that's not helpful, and that's not a good way. Like, just going somewhere and making a scene, like going into a private business without a mask on and filming yourself just being an ass, right? Is not, I don't feel like that's a good approach, right? And of course, all of the people on the other side who are just hysterical, same thing. So yeah, I mean, I back to where we were in the beginning, just like finding some kind of middle ground was important there to promote balance at a time where people didn't seem to want to have any. But this group that you're talking about, yes, they are, it is like, I see the left doing a lot of things like this on a lot of different issues, but it is almost like, I saw this video of like a high school dance where the kids had to like lock arms and dance back to back. And I was like, this is like cry for help performance art. And the left has lots of different venues for that, in social justice and in politics and certainly with this. I mean, it's like, watch me destroy a whole city. Like, I'm the mayor. Watch me destroy my city as a form of performance art to know what my commitment to this religion is. Watch the city that I'm in charge of burn right behind me.
I've heard people refer to them as Branch Covidians. Yeah. I'd rather have David Koresh as a neighbor than any one of these people any day of the mm-hmm. week.
Yeah.
Any one of the, you could talk to David Koresh. You could reason with David Koresh. I mean, it was, I know a lot about the guy. I've studied Waco a lot more than most people. And I would much rather have him than the typical Karen, living next door to me through all this and everything. At least I know that he'd have faith. He wouldn't be like some of these weak ass Christians who just bought into fear. That's one thing I never could understand when I was a Christian, was why people are so, it's like, why are you so scared of, isn't what, so God takes care of you through this and this and this, but he won't take care of you through a virus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just,
I think a lot of us have feared for a long time, something that we only really saw like in terms of ideas, which was like the horizontal policing. That's existed since, I've seen it in public dialogue since the Ron Paul days of 2008 or 2012. It really, really took off when the social justice war escalated in like 2014. But this is the greatest conditions for horizontal policing that we've ever seen, right? Snitch hotlines, all the people shaming each other in public. I think James Corbett was probably the first one. He started collecting, just people on the street footage from New York City, like very, very early on when, they're shouting at each other, flatten the curve, go inside, go home, that kind of thing. Put your mask on. But you and I were here in April, right? Like, this is going to drive people apart. It's really going to break the social fabric more than it already is. And my project right now is really like maintain your own sanity and how to do that and how to operate in your sphere of control and how to budget the time and mental and emotional resources you devote to politics and to know what your threshold is. And like, yeah, we said at the beginning of the call, I'm at Richard Grove's house. This is I'm stopping here on my way down south. And Rich is somebody who I've known for, 10, 11 years, and I've always been very impressed with his threshold. Right, for the amount of information that he can take in about this stuff. Like, Tom Woods is another one. He's just better. Like, it's just a different constitution, right? I don't have that kind of room. I mean, I could make it and I could practice, and I'm sure I could put myself in like a mental space to be more receiving. But for me personally, like with my psychology, I don't feel like there were a lot of payoffs for how invested I got in this thing this year and how much of my own enemy imagery, you know, I adopted towards other people. I think that pushed me into emotional thinking. I think it pushed me into reactive decision-making in a couple of cases, you know, some more costly than others. But, you know, 2020 was preparation. 2020 was a test, as I said on my show. And maybe it's a test of something bigger. Maybe it's a test of something harder. But I think as this year comes to a close, it's been good to like reflect on the lessons of the last 9 months and really like the running start of the last 5 years that, you know, laid the groundwork for this crisis to be so disastrous in this country with the destabilization. I feel pretty good going into 2021. I feel like I've acknowledged my mistakes and I've learned a thing or two. And I hope I can just continue to, you know, do what I do and offer people some hope while not ignoring the black pill. You know, I get it. But a kind of strategic hopelessness, like a hopelessness. And I think we're kind of saying the same thing, right? About like, what does libertarianism have to add to this conversation at this point? Not much, right? I will take it out of the political and encourage people to pursue, you know, individual liberty in the areas of their lives that are important to them. But it's not a political project at this point. All we can do is, you know, I said this to you before, and, you know, your show is beyond the wall, but there was some other nasty stuff on the other side of the wall too. And all we can do is hold the wall, right? That's what politics is at this point. I know that from being in New Hampshire, right? The libertarians I know who are in politics, mostly as Republicans, they're just like, you know, the people who hate freedom, who moved here from Massachusetts and elsewhere, they come to work every day. They love it when we're not here, because they can do whatever they want. So it is basically just a stopper at this point. And I think everything else is outside of that realm. And so that's a huge part of my message. But the most important place is in here for me. And I think for everybody else, right? It's not just about the maintenance of sanity. It's about the strengthening of it and the strengthening of the resources that we have for ourselves and that we have for other people. So that's where my attention will be in 2021.
My attention is going to be teaching people, especially people who call themselves libertarians and ANCAPs, that with the exception of a couple Ron Paul movements, you people have been on your heels defending your position for 60 years. Mm-hmm. And that has to end. You have to go on the offensive now. And if you don't, I mean, you're just... who knows what's in store. I mean, they're already talking about, you know, all right, you take the vaccine, you still have to wear the mask, you still have to social distance, you still have to wash your hands all the time, because it could stop you from getting the virus and prevent you from getting the virus, but you still may be able to asymptomatically spread the virus. And it's like, okay, you couldn't come up with something for that? I mean, is that beyond the scope of medicine? So I don't see this subsiding. You know, I thought I've been saying since the first time I heard somebody say COVID-19 will be cured after the election.
Yep.
I've been saying that's the blue pilled opinion, that anyone who said that held to a blue pilled opinion. And I'm one of those people that doesn't want to be right when I make predictions like that. You know, it's like, I would rather be wrong, you know, and yes. I'll admit when, you know, I'm pretty good at admitting when I screw something up. But I was right on that one. Mm-hmm. And I was right on a lot of things this year. I underestimated some things this year. I thought that only half the country would still be wearing masks in July. Yeah. I didn't realize it was going to be, you know, December. And if you're near a major city, if you're near a blue city, 99% of the people are, you know, wearing masks, and I would be willing to bet half of them don't know why at this point. It's just an article of clothing.
And it's a false sense of security too. Like, let's just say that the virus is as real and as dangerous as we thought it might be 9 months ago, you know, this strain. If that's true, this has become such a political issue And we saw it happening then, but it's way more so now, just because it's been reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. I'm watching election footage of poll workers, people right on top of each other wearing these crappy cloth masks like they do anything, you know? And because it's been...
It's the spittle. It's the big pieces of spittle. It's the big pieces of spittle. I've been told that so many... It's the big piece of the spittle.
The dividing line, right? I want to
smack everyone in the mouth who says that.
The dividing line between the science and the non-science, right?
Yeah.
The responsible and the idiot. The masks is the differentiator. So if you have a mask on, it's like, yeah, who cares about your immune system? Who cares about pre-existing conditions? Who cares about how overweight you are? You've got a mask on. It's made of cloth. It was $1.99 and it came in a pack of 25, right? You're on the side of good, right? You're one of the responsible people. So that's really disappointing to see the media maybe like endangering people by giving them, by using this narrative that produces this anger and division. And I think in this case, this is bad division, because while division might be good in a larger political context, as far as driving change, it's not good for critical thinking and it's not good for people's emotional health. Right. So do we have to abandon critical thinking and emotional health even more than we already have to produce change? Gosh, I don't, maybe it's sad. Right. But maybe things have to get really wild here, and maybe they're about to. Maybe we're in some period of status quo for a while, but I don't think so. Right.
Like, dude, there's 50 to 60 to 70 million people in this country who believe that Trump, their guy, had the election stolen from them. And a lot of those people own guns.
Yeah, I would say they're the big demographic of gun owners for sure. Yeah. And yeah, I think that's going to be, I don't know how I feel about that. Well, I do know how I feel about that. I don't like that. I don't like civil unrest, right? I don't want to see a right-wing response to, I mean, in an academic sense, and I was even sympathetic, like I want to hear people like Yarvin out, or one of my recent guests said something similar, like somebody has to, if you want to live in a free society someday, you're going to have to pass the torch in the meantime to somebody who understands how power works, mm-hmm. right? You're going 100%. To have to go in an authoritarian direction to get there. And then like, maybe the best hope you have is that somebody, you know, uses that kind of power and then goes, you know, don't want it. Prioritize freedom over, you know, all of the benefits that I get from this power. And that seems like a risky proposition to me as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, libertarianism is a fringe movement. Conservatism is a mainstream political movement that conserved nothing in its entire existence, right? The leftward march has just been, and you know, I've said, like, if you control the culture and you control the schools, like people go into public schools, they're little crappy boats. You go to public school for 12 years, you get a sail, but no sailor. You go out in the water, the wind blows you left, right? That's just, it's like I've said before, people who are progressives and liberals walk around like they have some kind of sophisticated worldview that they earned. All they had to do to get it was sit in front of the television, sit in front of what Hollywood puts out, sit in a public school classroom, sit in a college classroom, and absorb everything they've ever been told without questioning any of it. And you'd arrive right there, right? You earned nothing. So, you know, we come out of the schools, we're blown to the left. People can't see that, right? Because it's that is the culture. So the right, and if you want to put libertarianism in there, surrendered all of that. You know, I hate doing this left right thing, but you can't avoid this. When you look at the progressive project over the 20th century and all of the different opposing and flip flopping positions that they've adopted, just in a quest for power, right? Just in a quest for power. Like, how stale is it, like Dinesh D'Souza or Candace Owens talking about how, oh, these people were the racists, you know? Who cares? Yeah. Right? Their mission has always been the same.
That's blue pill.
Yeah.
If you have to bring that up, it's blue pill. I mean, right. I mean, who's listening to that? Who are you strengthening? Whose mind are you changing to go, well, you know, the Democrats were the party of slavery at one point. Yeah. No one cares. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do most people think about slavery in this country? That, the Civil War was fought to end it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're talking to idiots.
It's boring.
Find a better message, find a better narrative. because you have to, the only way, okay, you know how we get out of this? We find a better narrative. We have to have a better narrative.
Yeah.
Facts and, if facts and logic aren't going to do it and narratives rule the day, we have to find a better narrative.
Selling with stories, right?
Yeah.
Selling with stories.
I could do it.
Yeah.
I had to write. I remember writing some of the writing classes in college, just going in there like 2 days a week and being like, okay, you're going to write a short story today.
Yeah.
I can do it.
Right. And that's tricky for people who spend a lot of time in the world of ideas. And, you know, it's kind of like one of the reasons, like, I don't blame left and right wing people in the traditional political sense of like trying to talk to, you know, Republicans when Ron Paul was on the scene, or trying to talk to people on the left today. They are just in echo chambers where they feel like they're right. Well, we're outside of that, like trying to get into the conversation and trying to, like, what we're both saying, like, there's no point to doing now, get into like having credibility in that scene. So we study both sides. We learn all their arguments. We predict, and like, we're not the only people who find that useful, how like knowing what somebody's political affiliation is, you can basically predict what they're going to feel about anything that happens. But we find it useful too, right? Like the scientific managers of society like that. And so do we, because it lets us win arguments. But then those people don't acknowledge that we won arguments. And it's just Groundhog Day the next time we see them, right? We have to live that same day all over again. So we sit outside and we practice and we strategize, and they don't, right? So they don't know what hit them when people who have, you know, traditionally lined up with libertarianism come at them. And like, the only thing they can do is just edit us out of their reality. You know, I see that happen again and again, and it's gotten, you know, worse in the last 4 or 5 years. So that is a losing battle, right? Outreach is a losing battle. Politics is a losing battle. And if there is going to be, you know, some kind of momentum gained here, I think you're absolutely right. I think Trump came in with a compelling story. It was kind of simple. It was kind of stupid, but it was a story, right? It was a story about taking everybody somewhere, right? About, it was a story about change, you know, and that worked. And, you know, the people who promote freedom and want to see a freer world, you're right. We don't have that. Ron Paul took a stab at it, but he wasn't the right messenger and it wasn't the right time, you know? So
I have a feeling in the next 4 years, there's going to be a messenger who's going to step forward and who's going to go even beyond what Ron Paul did, but I'll just leave it at that.
I love that. I'm happy to hear that. That sounds great to me. I hope that does happen.
I may know something.
That excites me. That definitely excites me. So we've done 90 minutes. What else do you want to do before we wrap up?
Why don't you just, if there's anything that you had thought you might want to talk about and or mention that you haven't yet, why don't you just bring that out?
I came here with zero plan. You know, okay. I mean, this is like the third time we've done a show. I said, I know this is going to be great. I'm eager to hear where Pete's at the end of the year, having talked to him back in the spring. And I certainly got what I wanted out of this. So I really appreciate the conversation. It's always great to connect with you. And I'll just get my website, schoolsucksproject.com. If people are unfamiliar with me and they enjoyed this, please just go, you know, scroll through our podcast feed on whatever podcatcher that you use and find something that's interesting to you and start there. Like, let's build a one-way relationship with my voice in your ear and, you know, give it 3 episodes. And I think you'll like what we're doing if you like this show. So I'm up for this anytime, Pete. This was awesome.
Thanks, man. Really appreciate it.
Excellent.
I want to thank you for tuning into the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Brett for coming back on. That's it. Be back in a few days with another episode. Take care and bye.